start out, I'm going to put up here a quote here. Currently, the government is indeed paying substantial attention to privacy issues on several fronts. The Federal Trade Commission is conducting a long-term privacy initiative and is planning a privacy workshop to study technical tools and self-regulatory models. The Commerce Department is compiling a report on the issue around privacy self-regulation. As a general matter, says the NTIA chief counsel, we favor self-regulation, but self-regulation with teeth. There are also several bills pending in Congress. Okay, so this quote sounds pretty much like what's going on today, but actually this was written in 1997. And in preparing for this talk, I kind of went in with the feeling that there was a lot of deja vu here. But I started going through some old documents. And when I hit on this article by Esther Dyson, you know, it really kind of clinched it for me that, you know, we're really seeing a lot of the same thing over and over again. Because, you know, right now we do see the Federal Trade Commission just came out with a report, the Department of Commerce came out with a report, and a privacy bill was introduced last week. There's a lot of talk these days about standardizing privacy notices. And if we look at what happened over the past few years, we see there's this industry effort to develop this ad choice icon, and Yahoo has started rolling it out, and some other companies are starting to do that as well. Here at Berkeley, there was a student project that put together these no privacy icons, which is another effort to kind of standardize the vocabulary around privacy. Trustee keeps talking about standardizing privacy policies, and just in September, in one of their blog posts, they talked about trying to put together machine-readable XML policies. Then over at Mozilla, they've come up with a set of privacy icons. Then these were put together at the end of last year. It's not clear what they're going to do with them, but they've got them. And then, of course, in the FTC report, they talk about making privacy notices clearer, shorter, and more standardized to better enable comprehension and comparison of privacy policies. So lots and lots of talk about the standardization, icons, XML, but I can't help thinking, privacy nutrition labels, yes, the Future of Privacy Forum, yeah, they talked about what's in is privacy nutrition labels, yes, but okay, so I can't help thinking, though, about Groundhog Day, because, you know, this is really stuff that we heard back in 1996 and 1997, and so a lot of this over and over again. So I actually spent some time over the past few weeks trying to go back into history and digging out some of these things. I remembered that, you know, when I read this thing about trustees saying that they wanted to have XML privacy policies, and there was something else where they talked about icons, I remembered that a long time ago, trustee had different privacy icons. It actually took a lot of effort to find them. I think they've tried to obliterate them from the internet, but the Internet Archive still had them. And back in December 1996, Trustee published three different privacy trust marks, which were supposed to represent different data sharing practices that companies might have. So that was kind of interesting. I also looked at what went on with P3P at the time, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about P3P, so don't worry if you're not up on what that is. But in 2002, the World Wide Web Consortium published this little brochure on P3P. It quoted Christine Varney, former FTC commissioner, as saying, P3P will help responsible online business empower users to choose the privacy relationship best for them. Larry Lessig said, in the context of proper legislation, P3P is the most promising solution to cyberspace privacy. It will make it easy for companies to explain their practices in a form that computers can read, and make it easy for consumers to express their preferences in a way that computers will automatically respect. Does that sound similar to some of the things that are being talked about today? Okay, so with that introduction, here's what I'd like to talk about today. I'm going to start with a very brief introduction to P3P to kind of get you all up to speed. I want to talk about the privacy taxonomy that's associated with P3P. talk about some work on privacy nutrition labels, a little bit about adoption and enforcement, and then finally conclude with some brief personal recommendations as we move forward. Okay, so P3P has its origins in looking at the problem of privacy policies being things that are really long and difficult for consumers to read and understand. The FTC said in their current report, the notice and choice model as implemented has led to long, incomprehensible privacy policies that consumers typically do not read, let alone understand. And I think there's pretty widespread agreement on that. As I was just talking in Deirdre's class and observed that, in fact, we have privacy policies today that are so difficult to read and understand that we can program a computer to play Jeopardy, but we cannot program a computer to read privacy policies. So what we would like to do, though, is make privacy policies such that your computer can read them for you. And the way to do that is not to put them in English, but to put them in a computer language. And that was the idea behind P3P. The World Wide Web Consortium, which is the organization that developed HTML and things like that, was the organization that developed P3P. And it is a computer-readable XML format for privacy policies. It also has an optional format for something called a compact privacy policy, which is just the privacy policies for cookies only. And it's something that's actually built into Internet Explorer 6, 7, and 8. Most IE users have no idea, but trust me, if you use IE, you have it on your computer. P3P has a long history. It was originally discussed at an FTC meeting in 1995. Then in 1996, there was an ad hoc group that included industry representatives as well as nonprofit representatives in the Internet Privacy Working Group. And so that was convened in 1996. In 1997, W3C began working on P3P. They chartered a whole series of working groups in order to do this. And originally, we thought that this was going to be a pretty easy process, a few months, maybe a year or two. It actually ended up taking a really long time. We added all sorts of features. We took all sorts of features out. We kept going back and forth. There was a whole patent issue that blew up the whole process for a while. But eventually, in 2002, we came out with a P3P standard. And then immediately we began work on P3P 1.1 because nobody was happy with P3P 1.0. And we churned on that for a while, and then eventually everybody lost interest, and in November 2006 we closed the group for good. All right, the original idea behind P3P was not only that computers could read the policies for you, but also that they could actually negotiate about privacy. And we had this notion of something that looked kind of like this, where your web browser would talk to a website, and so here we have the web browser on the right, talking to the website on the left, and the website on the left says, "Will you send me your address?" And the web browser says, "Only if you won't use it to market to me." And they could continue haggling along until they reached some sort of an agreement. And that would be the binding agreement between that particular user agent and that particular website. So that was kind of the vision. It didn't really work out that way, though. The negotiation aspect turned out to be very difficult technically, and also companies weren't really all that comfortable with the idea of having a whole set of privacy policies. You know, it was hard enough to come up with one, let alone one that you could negotiate about. So what we ended up releasing in 2002 was something that did not have negotiation. It was just a simple way for websites to take their privacy policy and express it in XML. They didn't have to have any special software on their web servers. They could just put this chunk of XML on their server. And then users who had software that could read it would be able to have their software grab that XML and do something useful with it. What it would do, that was left as an exercise for the developers to figure out. The P3P specification basically had everything that you needed to specify this chunk of XML. It also had some rules about where websites should put the XML on their site so that user agents could find it. There were some There were some rules about how to put this simple compact policy with cookies so that that could be done quickly and things like that. For those of you who want to know what XML looks like, this is what it looks like. Clearly meant for computers, not for humans to read. So when IE6 came out, it had P3P built in. Here's where you could actually see it. So that little eyeball with a do not enter sign that's circled at the bottom, you probably can't see from back there that that's what it is, but any of you who've ever used Internet Explorer may have seen this symbol. I think it's one of the best kept secrets of IE that if I ask people who haven't heard my lectures or taken my class, you know, what does that symbol do? Most of them have very little idea. But what that means is that IE has blocked cookies on the basis of P3P. And if you click on it, it actually brings up a list of cookies and tells you what it did with them. There's also, under the view menu in IE, there's a privacy report. And if you click on that, it goes and actually fetches the XML P3P policy, and it will translate it into English or French or German or whatever language your browser is in. And there's also, under the Internet Options menu, there are privacy settings that you can go to and actually control how IE blocks cookies on the basis of P3P. By default, the 99.999% of users who have never changed to this all have the medium setting. And on that medium setting, websites that use third-party cookies that don't have P3P, those cookies are going to be blocked. And cookies that IE finds unsatisfactory by Microsoft's definition are also going to be blocked. There are other P3P user agents as well. This is one that we developed at CMU based on work that had started at AT&T when I was there, and this is called Privacy Finder. You can actually go try this out yourself at privacyfinder.org. So this is a search engine where you type in your search, and it will go and make your search in one of the major search engines, and it takes the results, and for each website that comes back, it looks to see if they have a P3P policy. And if they do, it then analyzes it and comes up with a privacy score. And we see this privacy meter down the left side, those little green boxes. And under those green boxes, there's a link that says privacy report. And that's where we take that XML and translate it back into English. And in our latest version, we have something we call a privacy nutrition label, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. Okay, so that's P3P in a nutshell. So one of the core parts of P3P is actually that privacy language, the privacy taxonomy, which is encoded into XML. The XML encoding is the easy part. The hard part was coming up with that language to talk about privacy. Because at the time that we started, there was no standard language to talk about privacy. So a lot of time was spent trying to figure out, well, what should be in such a language? And so at a high level, here are the pieces. We need to know who we're dealing with. What is the website that we're dealing with? How do we find them? We need to know what kind of data they actually collect, how they use it, whether you can opt in or opt out of various uses. And one of the decisions we made in P3P was to focus on secondary uses. So we don't have a taxonomy for, you know, we use it to ship you products. We use it to fulfill your orders. We use it for all the different things that a first party might use it for. Instead, we focus on secondary uses like advertising and telemarketing and things like that. We also have vocabulary elements to talk about sharing. To what extent will a company actually share your data? We also talk about data retention policies, the kind of access people have to their own data, and mechanisms for resolving privacy disputes. Okay, looking at this in kind of a structural diagram, which engineers always like these nice box diagrams here. So it's certainly easier than showing you the XML. So here we have a policy, and the policy has in it a bunch of required elements and optional elements. So at the top level, we have things like the entity, which is who we're dealing with. And then we have at the bottom, you must have at least one statement. And the statement is really the meat of the policy. And here it is. Okay, and the statement has the purpose, recipients, retention, and data that's in the policy. And those little numbers that I have there tell you how many multiple choice options we have for each of these things. So you can see there are 12 purposes, 6 recipients, 5 retention elements, and 17 data elements. Right, so a company that's trying to set up their XML privacy policy has to go through each of these and determine which ones actually match what's in their policy. Okay, so that's the P3P vocabulary in a nutshell. But this is something which took many years to actually develop. And so a question people often ask is, well, what was so difficult about it? There were a number of things that turned out to be rather problematic. One was that the various stakeholders involved all had different objectives. We had people from industry and we had privacy advocates, and they each had different things that they were trying to get out of having this computer-readable privacy policy, and therefore different opinions about what was important to encode in it. There were also people from different countries, and the laws in their countries with respect to privacy were different. So there were some people who said, well, there are certain types of data practices that are illegal in France, and therefore they should not be represented in this vocabulary. No one could ever do them because they're not legal. On the other hand, people in the US said, well, they're legal in the US and we're going to do them, and so we need to be able to express the fact that we're doing them. So lots of controversy there. Huge controversy about definitions, defining all sorts of different things that turned out not to be straightforward. One that kept coming up was, what is personally identifiable information? Is IP address personally identifiable information? These are debates that continue on 15 years later. In P3P, we punted. We decided not to define it. Instead, we said, just tell us what you collect, and everybody can decide, you know, tell us you collect IP address, and people can decide whether they want to consider that PII or not. It doesn't matter. We just want to know that you collect IP address. Done. I think that was an extremely wise move, and I'm really glad we did that. And I would encourage others to think about things in that sort of way as well. There was also a question about scope. P3P doesn't make any statements about the website security policies. Some people thought we should. We decided that was out of scope. As I mentioned, originally we were going to have negotiation. That got cut out. At some point along the way, we were going to put in something about data transfer. It seemed like a nice idea that if a website enumerates, this is what we're collecting, and the user agrees that it's okay, why should the user have to type it all in? Just have your web browser autofill and send it. So we spent a lot of time trying to make an autofill protocol. That got taken out. And then finally, finding the right degree of granularity was extremely difficult. In a lot of these areas, some people said, well, I can think of really five purposes of data use that users would actually care about, and we're done. And other people said, well, no, there's at least 50. And we had to agree on some level of granularity that was good enough. So just to give you an example from another field, let's look at movie ratings. All right, so you can imagine somebody tells you in a review that in this movie the characters are not well developed and there's gratuitous sex and violence, and from that we give it a thumbs down. Okay, so that gives us some information about a movie. We can also imagine that all we know is the thumbs down, and it might be because of these two reasons, but there might be actually all sorts of other reasons that somebody gave the movie a thumbs down. So clearly, had we enumerated all the reasons we liked or didn't like the movie, we would have a lot more information than just knowing the thumbs down. So in P3P, early on, we decided we weren't going to go with the thumbs up, thumbs down approach. P3P doesn't say good privacy, bad privacy. We decided we needed the detail, but how much detail? So let's just look at one P3P element, recipients. So who are you going to share the data with? Some people proposed that it was easy. We have two buckets. Either you share data or you don't share data. Pretty straightforward, right? The problem is that companies share data for lots of different reasons in different ways. Some of the ways they share data might actually be completely innocuous from a privacy perspective. And so companies said, well, we really need to express this very nuanced information about our data sharing. So it was suggested that we have tokens for share with parent company, share with affiliates, share with unaffiliated parties, share with contractors, share with subsidiaries, share in public forums. And the list went on and on and on. And at one point, I had a list of 36 different ways you could share data. The consumer advocates, quite rightly, I think, said, this is crazy. Consumers don't really care if you're sharing it with your parent company or with your affiliates or whatever. You're sharing data, right? So we couldn't actually boil it down to two, but we boiled it down to six. And so P3P does have just six different ways of talking about sharing data. Now, other groups that have tried to express data sharing have come up with different conclusions over the years. And I actually, over the past few weeks, as an exercise, went and dug out some of them and tried to see how they map to the P3P vocabulary. So let's go back to eTrust 1996. eTrust 1996, in hindsight, I would have to say makes no sense whatsoever. Because what they said is the first choice is to say no exchange, which means that you don't even give data to the website. But you can't not give data to the website because web browsers give data to the website whether they want it or not. So I don't think that makes any sense. Then there's one-to-one exchange, which says we give data to the website and the website will not share it with absolutely anyone. But almost every company shares it with their service providers, even if it's under contract and they're acting as their agents. But that original one-to-one exchange didn't actually allow that. So everything got lumped into third-party exchange. And so all six of the P3P recipients are all captured by that one third-party exchange there. If we look at the No Privacy Project, there we actually have a pretty nice mapping onto P3P. They talk about affiliate sharing, and P3P has share with companies with similar privacy policies. They talk about sharing with contractors. P3P talks about sharing with agents. They talk about public display. P3P talks about sharing in public forums. And then they have a third parties, which captures, I think, three P3P elements. There's one where I put a question mark on, and that's share with delivery companies. And this is something which I don't know the answer to. At the time that we developed P3P, we talked about when you share with your agent, that should be a company that you have a contractual relationship with, and they have to follow your privacy policy, and they can't use the data for anything else. And people told us that delivery companies like FedEx, you don't have that kind of contract with. And I don't know if that's ever been resolved. And if anybody knows, I'd be interested to hear. Because I think that's actually still a problem where we just sort of assume that FedEx isn't going to take that information and do anything bad with it. But I'm not sure we know contractually that they can't. So that's an open question. My students at CMU developed a privacy nutrition label, which I'll talk more about. And there, we actually overlaid this on top of P3P. And we basically have three types of sharing. So we took all of the different sharing with third parties and called that other companies. We also have a box for public forums. And then we assume that that everybody is going to share with their agents and with delivery companies. And so there's no specific symbol to tell anybody that you do that. We just assume everybody does it. Then we looked at the Mozilla privacy icons, which I also must say make no sense to me. The Mozilla privacy icons, I just pulled out the ones that have something to do with sharing. There's a whole bunch of others. And they have one that says your data is never bartered or sold. Your data is never given to advertisers. Data is given to law enforcement only when legal process is followed. And that doesn't actually map to any of the P3P recipients. Then there's your data is bartered or sold, and the site gives your data to advertisers. That sort of maps, but it's really a very particular, specialized type of sharing. And then data may be given to law enforcement even without legal processes, which again is not really captured by P3P. So I think these Mozilla privacy icons are kind of out there and don't really map to the kinds of things that we've heard over many years or the kinds of things that people actually want to express in privacy policies. Okay, so as I've gone through a bunch of these examples, you can see there. You might ask, you know, why not just have a very detailed privacy vocabulary? There are a lot of advantages of that. It does allow maximum expressiveness, but there are also disadvantages because it does actually get very difficult for policy authors to figure out, well, which bucket am I in? You know, which kind of sharing exactly am I doing? And it's also difficult for user agent implementers to get it right. There's some reason to really think about this granularity problem and come up with something that kind of, you know, is just about right there. Okay. In general, on reflection about the P3P vocabulary, and thinking about, despite the fact that P3P hasn't been tremendously successful, it seems like the vocabulary we came up with back in 2002 is actually still today more or less what I think you want and what you would, if you were coming up with a vocabulary today, what you would probably come up with. And looking at what's in the recent FTC staff report, I think it's actually consistent with some of the things that they're asking for. So they talk about saying, we don't really need to worry about those primary purposes of data use. We need to talk about the things that will surprise consumers. Those are the secondary uses. And that also is the focus of the P3P vocabulary. I think that we did actually anticipate some of the new uses, like location. That wasn't an issue in 2002. There was no Foursquare, but there is now, and we have the location element. The peer-to-peer data sharing that we have in things like Facebook, I think, is sort of captured in P3P, but perhaps could be captured better. Okay, so I'm going to run through a few other things, a lot I want to say in a short amount of time. So privacy nutrition labels. This is an effort that we started working on at CMU with the idea of, can we build a better privacy policy? We'd like a privacy policy that people can actually understand and find information, and you can compare two policies side by side, just like you can look at these breakfast cereals and see which one has more calories and more fat and things like that. Why can't I do that for privacy policies? So my students started looking at, well, what are the good things about nutrition labels? And a big thing is that they're standardized, standardized format. They have standardized language. Some of the language is technical jargon, but we all learn it. We all learned what trans fats are and things like that because it's very consistent. It's also brief, and it's linked to an extended view where you've got the full ingredients down at the bottom. So we looked at a bunch of other different types of consumer notices. Most of them tend to be in the environmental, nutrition, and drug area. And we got a lot of ideas. In trying to apply them to the privacy area, some of the issues that we had, though, were that people are not very familiar with privacy terminology. There's also a lot of issues where context matters. It's not that it's always 35 calories, no matter whether you eat it inside or outside, lunch or dinner, right? But in fact, what type of data and how they use it are very context dependent. There's a lot of complexity, and people really don't understand the implications of what they're doing. So we used an iterative design process that involved lab studies, focus groups, online studies to try to develop a privacy nutrition label. This is my student, Patrick Kelly, who actually did a lot of this work and won an award for it. This was our first attempt. This is terrible. I'll say it up front. We developed it. We kind of knew it wasn't so good. We ran a user study. Then we really knew it wasn't so good. it's completely information overload. We actually capture every element of a P3P policy in this. It actually scrolls. It has scroll bars. It goes on for a long time. It has like seven different symbols. They're all different shades of teal. Sorry. All right, so, but we learned a lot from doing it, and we moved on, and so after that, we backed up and went and looked at nutrition labels again and said, okay, let's get our head around this, right? And we evolved, and we did more user studies, and we came up with something that looks sort of like this. So what we had in the version that we wrote our last paper on is, so we do have this very standardized format. We have four symbols, the red box, the light blue box, the opt-out box, and the opt-in box. And we have a key at the bottom that tells you what they mean. All right, so this makes it very simple. We also designed the colors such that you could just kind of squint at it and see the intensity of red and have an idea about how much data they collect and how much they use it for. We designed it so you can put two side by side and you can see it at a glance comparisons between two companies. We also wanted to use all of P3P, but in a simplified format. So the grid on the left is what it would look like if we had used every P3P element. And the grid on the right is what it actually looks like because we ended up collapsing P3P elements. So we reduced rows by saying, okay, well, there are certain types of data that people don't really differentiate between. So we're going to say physical contact information, online contact information. We're smushing them together into one contact information row. On the P3P website, there's a complete list of all of these things. We did the same thing for columns as well. There's four different ways that you can talk about profiling in P3P. We smushed them down into one profiling column. All right, so then we did an online study after many focus groups and whatnot. We had almost 800 people go through, and we showed them a bunch of different privacy policies and asked them questions about them. So we had our standardized label. Then we had a short version of it where we took out all the rows that represented we don't collect this. We also took the whole grid and we translated it into English sentences, and we wanted to test that as well. We had a standard set of definitions and legends that were on all of these. We compared this with full policy text, which went on and on and on. We also compared this with layered policy texts, and this was based on an industry effort to develop these kind of short layered privacy notices. For all of these, we used real companies' policies, but we took out the company names, and they all became ACME. Okay, so what did we find? Looking at the accuracy with which people were able to answer questions, like, you know, will this website share your data with other companies, we found that all of the standardized formats were significantly better than the full policy or the layered policy as far as accuracy. People could answer much more accurately. We found that speed-wise, how fast they could do it, we found that they also were faster, and that with our standardized tables were actually faster than the standardized text by a little bit. We also asked people how painful or enjoyable this experience was, and there we actually didn't find any statistically significant differences except that everybody didn't like the full policy. We also asked them a lot of free response questions, and for questions about the full policy, we got answers like this. Torture to read and understand, like Japanese stereo instructions. You don't want anybody to say that about anything you created, right? Whereas for the standardized formats, we got comments like, this layout for privacy policies is much more consumer friendly. I hope this becomes the industry standard. It does seem that that there are a lot of benefits to a standardized approach, it may not be even so important as to what the standard is, but the fact that it is very standardized, that you use consistent layout and terminology. We have integrated this into Privacy Finder, so if you actually want to see it in action, go to privacyfinder.org and you can actually try this out. And we generate these automatically from the P3P for sites that have them. In our ongoing work, we're working on making that interactive. Okay, so coming back to P3P adoption. We've been looking at, okay, this long time since 2002, is anybody using P3P? So we've done a number of studies to find out. I don't have time to go through all the details, but basically we've looked at, we've collected common search terms, and then we've run those searches, and then we've looked at the sites that come up and say, do they use P3P? We found that if you do typical search terms, 10% of the results have P3P. If you focus on e-commerce search terms, 21% do. So there's more interest in P3P from e-commerce companies, which kind of makes sense. We also found that if you do a search and you hope that, you know, at least one of the top 10 search results has P3P, in fact, about two-thirds of the time, you'll find that. You also hope that the sites that have P3P that come up actually have good policies, and they don't just tell you, you know, we do whatever you want with your data. And we found that about a third of the time you can find a site with P3P that has a good policy by some definition of good. But we also found there were a lot of errors in P3P policies, which was fairly troubling. Then we did a follow-up study focusing on P3P compact policies because they're a lot easier to evaluate. We looked at over 33,000 P3P compact policies that are out there in the wild. And we looked for various types of errors that we could find through automatic processing. Right, so this is not even checking to see if they're lying. We're only looking to see if they have syntactically correct and internally consistent policies that don't contradict themselves. And I'm going to skip over that. Okay, so so we looked at the policies that we looked at were the policies that we found in the Privacy Finder cache. We looked at all the trustee seal holders. We looked at the Quantcast top 100 websites. And we looked at the 75 network advertisers that were in the Beef Taco tool at the time that we looked at it. Okay, what we found, 34% of them had errors. And those were the errors that we could identify automatically. There were probably a lot more that we couldn't identify. So this was really troubling to find such a high rate of errors. So we started digging deeper. Why did we have all these errors? And it seemed that because Internet Explorer uses compact policies for cookie blocking, there was a big incentive for companies to try to come up with compact policies that would prevent their cookies from being blocked. And we also found that there were a lot of companies with identical errors. And when we dug deeper, we found out, well, there were 2,756 sites that had this compact policy as recommended by Microsoft on the Microsoft help and support site. After we published the paper, Microsoft took down that site pretty quickly. And there were other ones, there were various blogs that said, hey, are your cookies getting blocked? Just put this on your website. With no mention that actually this is kind of a contractual obligation and that you shouldn't just put it on your website if it's not what your company actually does. We looked at popular sites especially, and some of the ones that were really problematic, Amazon used a made-up token, AMZN. That was their entire P3P compact policy, because they found out that, i.e., if it doesn't find any bad tokens, it will allow the cookies. So if you make up a token, well, it's not on the list of bad tokens, must be good. Facebook had two tokens that were not required and didn't have any of the required tokens. Previously, when we checked, they just had the word honk. I don't know why. Okay. We observed that there were a lot of errors on Trustee websites. Trustee responded and basically said, yeah, well, P3P is irrelevant anyway, we don't care. The New York Times published a story about it, and that got people's attention, I think. So we just rechecked this last week. We found quite a few companies that just dropped their compact policies altogether. We found a few that were invalid before that are now valid. We went back to Amazon. They now have a valid P3P policy, but they have a note about why they don't like P3P. And that they've only made their compact policy valid and not their full policy. And Facebook has changed their compact policy to say, Facebook does not have a P3P policy, learn why here. This, of course, avoids IE cookie blocking. All right, so I think all of this points to how this whole P3P thing was pretty ineffective as self-regulation. And that we had a problem where there was a lack of incentives for compliance, and the main incentive came from Microsoft's implementation, and yet Microsoft's implementation was buggy and therefore an easy loophole. All right, so this leads me. I'm going to wrap up now, since I know I'm running long. Some conclusions and recommendations. All right, so the first one is that I think standardization of privacy policies is a good thing. And I think that our empirical studies show consistently that standardization is going to actually really help consumers. So I think that's something that we do want to move towards. I think machine-readable policies are also a good thing. And I think that's something that a lot of the more recent efforts on standardization don't necessarily include machine-readable policies. And there are some people who say, well, we tried that with P3P, it failed, forget it. There are other people who are now talking about machine-readable policies without any awareness of P3P. I think in general, though, even if we come up with nice symbols and whatnot, it's still a burden on users. And if we can have machine-readable policies, then we can build tools that can actually consume them and do something useful. I think layers are a good thing, and by layers I mean that we have that very simple view, an icon or a meter or something, and if you click on it, you can then get more details. I think that that's going to allow people to get something at a glance, but have the data there for people who want to actually go and read more. I think the concept of having actually standard policy types, and this is kind of what Creative Commons does. There, you know, there's a small number of things you can say in Creative Commons. I think this may work for privacy as well if we had a small number of different types of privacy policies, type 1, 2, 3, or give them nice names, and companies could say, look, you know, I'm a type 3 privacy policy, and you can go read it to find out all the details, but at least you have a good idea of what's going to be in there. I think, in general, the P3P vocabulary is really a good start, and that rather than reinventing the wheel, we should start with that, and we should look for very concrete examples of where it's failing or where it's not expressive enough and try to fix that rather than completely reinventing the wheel here. And finally, I think we need to think really hard about incentives and enforcement. So another bit from Esther Dyson from 1997, she said, industry disclosure schemes often founder without strong government public pressure. Otherwise, companies are simply too busy to adopt them, and customers don't factor the information disclosed into their buying habits. And I think this turned out to be exactly right. And I don't think going forward that any of the schemes that people are talking about with Do Not Track or icons or whatever could possibly be successful unless we can actually establish incentives for companies to actually use them. And I will end there. Thank you.